You're tuned into Kashmir Speaks on La Onda Bajita, reporting on the most densely militarized land on Earth. Tonight, we'll be talking about the disappeared in Kashmir. From 1989 to 2011, there have been 8,000 documented disappearances and 70,000 deaths of Kashmiris resulting from the Indian occupation. We're joined on the line by Athar Sia. She's a Kashmiri researcher. We'll be back after a short music break. You're tuned into Kashmir Speaks on La Onda Bajita. I'm Tara Darabji. That was the music by MC Cash. Tonight, we're joined on the line by Athar Sia. She is a Kashmiri and former journalist with the BBC. She also was an administrator with the Kashmiri government. Currently, her research focuses on the impact of the disappeared people in Kashmir. Thanks for joining us on KPFA, Athar Sia.
Hi, Tara. Thanks for having me.
And can you tell us a little bit why, your research focuses on the disappeared people and why you chose that as a topic?
To understand why I chose this as my research topic, I would like to talk a little bit about my experiences of living in Kashmir. Since 1989, there is an armed struggle going on and the Indian occupation on Kashmir is growing. So 1989, what happened was that many of the combatants and non-combatants were being disappeared by the Indian Army. And what I saw was that many women, especially mothers and wives, who have now come to be known as half widows, they came onto the street, and which was not something normal that is done in Kashmiri society, where a woman had a very private role. Not that they were not in the mainstream working as professionals as well, but it was not seen as graceful to be in the street trying to protest for something. And this kind of hooked me onto thinking about why this was happening. And I was young, and I kind of started my journey and my political sort of consciousness began from that point.
Author, can I interrupt you for a second? One of the things that I read in one of your pieces that really struck me was that you talked about how there is a stigma attached to showing grief in public for women. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Well, you know, when we say stigma, it kind of immediately has this sense of negativity, but it's not as much of a stigma in that sense. But it's more like when you are mourning, when you are trying to lament for something, it's not what you do in public. It's what is done within the four walls of your home, because Kashmiri society is not deeply conservative in that sense. Women have not had to protest in order to join the mainstream in that sense. I consider it, for the lack of a better word, a very benign patriarchy. But then, as you know, you look into traditions and you look into culture, mourning and grief has always stayed within the home. So when you think of these women who lost their sons, who lost their husbands through enforced disappearances, and then you see them coming out of the home, which is the refuge. They just come out and they sit in the street. They sit in the park. They go to a politician's bungalow. They go to meet army officers. They go to the high court. These were the places where men would be leading and women would not venture into easily because of all those, you know, let's say taboos or stigmas attached to it. So, but this rupture that took place in 89 to 94, that these women had to come out because there was no one else. And also there was also the security discrimination against men, that that they had to come out and they had to protest and they had to be in the street and they had to take a leading role in this movement.
And how has that shifted for women in terms of their roles and being able to come out in that way? And how has it, you know, you yourself are a Kashmiri woman. How do you feel that that's changing the whole community?
Well, it's really interesting. If you look at Kashmiri society and go to the late early 19th century, we see that they have come into mainstream, that they have men have not stopped the evolution and growth of women's role in the society. It's been a very nice segue from domesticity into the public role. And you can see that Kashmiri women, I'm not really sure, but I think there is around some 39% to 42% literacy rate currently. And women have really come into their own as professionals, as artists, as singers, as writers in that sense, Kashmiri writers more so, and also teachers and doctors. So we see that happening throughout, even during the armed struggle. There might have been a little, you know, ebbs and flows, but we see that happening even through that time period. But then going back to how this has changed them, I would say that this is like a forced mainstreaming that has happened. The women had no choice because there was no one else at home to go and look for the person, so they had to leave their homes. And mostly, what has happened is that many of the disappeared people, they come from the financially disadvantaged category, and they do not have many other people to help them with this. And these women have to go out, and there's no one else that they can ask for help.
There has been
sort of a forced mainstreaming, which has a bearing on how women are currently kind of evolving in Kashmir.
And Atharzia, can you talk a little bit more about, you mentioned that the people that are targeted for disappearances are often men, they're often from lower income levels. Can you tell our listeners a little bit more about who is being targeted for disappearances and how this happens? You know, I know that you've researched fairly closely several, you know, the instances of disappearances, but can you tell our listeners a little bit more about maybe a specific example or family or just the context in which it happens?
Well, I can tell you about, I mean, as an anthropologist, I follow these stories very closely. Like, the research is very ethnographic, it's very grounded. And the way these disappearances occur is very indiscriminate. There's a tacit policy that the Indian Army has, and through all the draconian laws that we have heard so much about, the OFSA and the Disturbed Areas Act, and all of those acts together make this army work with a lot of impunity, and it's a de facto occupational army. So the disappearances that it's gone down. Currently it's gone down. But at the same time, if you look at from the period of 89 till 2007, 2008, or even 2010, we see a lot of disappearances occurring. And it's not only the combatants; it's also the non-combatants, more so on the side of non-combatants. I give you an example of many mothers and half widows who I know. That their husbands who left in the morning for work didn't come back, or the sons who left for school didn't come back. We have a disappearance of a boy who was just 8 years old.
8 years old?
Yes, 8 years old. And then let's talk about Parveena Ahangar, who is she's the mother who is leading one of the APDPs, which is the Association of Parents of Disappeared People. She and human rights lawyer, activist Parvez Imroz, they formalized a group in 1994, which was called the Association of Parents of Disappeared Persons, the APDP. And Parveena is the mother of a young boy who just had joined college, and he was looking for a tutor for commerce, and during the night he was taken away. And to this day, I think her biggest thing is that while he was being taken away from his maternal uncle's house, that he was shouting her name. He was asking for his mom to help, and that help that she's giving him by what she says, that she's left her home and she's out there sitting in the street looking for him.
Can you talk a little bit about the impacts just emotionally on the families in terms of, you know, going year after year after year and not having any definitive answer of where their loved ones are?
Well, it's really a continuous murder that goes on, and they have no closure. There's no sense of closure. This is a wound that is open, that's festering, you know. Many times I've heard them say that it was better if we had the dead body and we knew that the person was dead. We had a grave that we'd go to. We had something in our hand. These people have nothing. I would like to call it a continuous murder. That's the only thing that comes to my mind. Because every day I go to their home as an ethnographer, as an anthropologist working with them, and there is this hope that the knock at the door might be him. But then there's also this sense that, you know, it's been so long, he won't be coming back. And the moment they step out of their homes when they are trying to look for this person through different means, and these means are very less. I mean, when the person disappeared, the police has not taken their first information report, which is a mandatory complaint or a request that is put up in the police station regarding a disappearance or an event that has happened. So there was a tacit policy that the police would not take any FIRs, the first information reports. And that's what has happened. I mean, most of these people have very little documentation. And now they're using other means to get that kind of documentation, even to admit that the person has been disappeared. That has been very hard for them. So then to have this emotional, this psychological burden of living this life where you are waiting for the person, and at the same time there is this understanding that the person might never come back again. It's been 4 long years, and I don't think there has been a single person who has been recovered so far.
And in terms of, I know that the Association of the Parents of the Disappeared have been in the forefront around requesting DNA testing from the mass graves that have been uncovered throughout Kashmir in many, many villages. Has there been any movement towards getting that DNA testing? I know that, you know, it's just been a slow process, and the government has only even recently recognize that these mass graves do exist, and that there are many Kashmiri civilians in there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the mass graves were discovered, and there is a recognition within the government as well, because the SHRC, which is the State Human Rights Commission, which had a big role to play in this, in trying to, discovery was done through the human rights organizations, but then just going and acknowledging that these mass graves and these unidentified graves do exist. But nothing has been done so far. There's a lot of clamor from some parts of the APDP, because right now we have two APDPs working. One is working under Parveena Anger, and the other one is under the patronage of Parvez Amroz. So they are looking for the DNA testing, and they are trying to work out how that might be possible. But I think the government, what they have done is that they have admitted this in a very vague / formal way, and now they have also talked about DNA testing, and that's where it stays. It's not going any further than that.
And Athrazia, why do you think that there's so little global or international attention on this? I mean, in Kashmir, you have 70,000 deaths, you have 8,000 documented disappearances, you have formalized, recognized mass graves. Why is there very much an international silence on Kashmir?
I think the Indian government has been very, very successful in portraying this as a bilateral issue between India and Pakistan. So every time we hear a clamor for solving Kashmir from some quarter, we hear that it's an internal dispute. I think the world community, the international community, they need to be made aware that this is not a bilateral dispute between India and Pakistan. There is a third party, a very important party involved, and that is the Kashmiris itself. The Kashmiris need to be asked what they want, and they have to be in the forefront. And I think in the coming years, we will see a lot of that happening. I'm looking at there's an intellectual dissent that is rising. There is this grassroots movement that is becoming bigger. And there's also a lot of sort of peace activists coming together and thinking about Kashmir. I think the situation in many ways is hopeful. But I think the biggest thing for this to be on the back burner is because we don't think of Kashmir as an issue of Kashmiris. We think it belongs to India and Pakistan, and they have to kind of work it out, which is not the case. The Kashmiri people have to be heard. It is a dispute that it's not a dispute in that sense. It's an occupational army that's working inside Kashmir that is suppressing Kashmir. I think the thing that needs to be understood is that this is an issue of Kashmiris as well. Maybe not as well. It's an issue of Kashmiris per se. And that needs to be recognized, and that needs to be talked about so that it comes out of this box of internal dispute between India and Pakistan, which always pushes it onto the back burner.
And Athrazia, you're a Kashmiri woman. What is your biggest hope for Kashmir?
Well, my biggest hope for Kashmir is for it to be independent, for it to be liberated. That's my biggest hope.
And Atta, you're a researcher, you're a former journalist, and you're also a poet. Do you have a poem to share with us tonight?
I do have a poem which was recently published in a South Asian magazine. And I wrote this poem. It was dedicated to all those people who have been tortured to death. And many of them, I'm sure, are the ones who are in the ranks of the disappeared. And this was written thinking about this one interrogation center, which is very notorious, and it's called Harinivas. Harinivas in Hindi means abode of God. It was a royal palace of the king early on, but then in the 80s and 90s, it was turned into this interrogation center. So the poem is dedicated to all those people who suffered the torture and all those people who survived. But as this poem was being published, at that time, Muhammad Afzal Guru, a Kashmiri, was also hanged without a fair trial in India. So this poem is dedicated to him as well, and it's titled Abode of God, A phantasm above, I'm the bones under this earth, where you plan to plant tulips, daffodils, so dear to my soil, trying to cover wide mouth fits, filled with shoes, limbs, amulets for protection, unblinking eyes, a first love charm bracelet, husbands, sons, lovers, fathers. Your rooms are clinging to their walls. The abode of God looks less so. No diviner dare carry a broom to erase my trace. In this dank darkness, tinged red, I'm not yet done etching tremulous lines on walls. I'm not done memorizing faces that are gone. I'm not done counting and keeping time which passed. There are still dead, dying in certain rooms. Thank you.
That was the voice of Atarzia. She's a poet, researcher, and former reporter with the BBC. Atarzia, thank you so much for joining us on Kashmir Speaks.
Thank you so much, Tara, for having me. This is the opportunity to talk about Kashmir and kind of I tell people that Kashmir is not an issue within India and Pakistan. It's an issue of Kashmiris, and we need to be heard. This occupation needs to end.
And we're hearing you on Kashmir Speaks. And if people want more information, are there any websites where people can either read your work or work that you think is really relevant?
Yeah, I do edit a website which is called kashmirlit.org. And this lit is not to be understood as lit as in literature, but this is Kashmir Lit, which means to be lit, you know. So www.kashmirlit.org, which would be KASHMIR.org.
Great. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Atarzia.
Thank you so much, Tara, for having me.
My pleasure. You're tuned into Kashmir Speaks on La Onda Bajita. Keep it locked, and we'll keep on cruising through Aztlan on this Friday night.